Say Oregon to anyone east of the Mississippi, and two things are likely to happen. First, the other person might ask, isn't it Oregon? Second, they probably see mental images of tall pine forests enveloped in misty rainfall, which does happen in Oregon. Today's a great example. But look east of the Cascades. So much of the land in the eastern half of the state is high desert. Wasteland in some eyes, highly valuable ecosystem in many others. Count the Oregon Natural Desert Association in that second category. ONDA's conservation director is Dan Morrison. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Dan, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I understand you're a man of the West, Colorado, previously. Can you explain the allure of these high, dry places to you?
Yeah, I sure can, Jeff. You know, I think for a lot of folks, that assumption that it's a wasteland is their first impression. But on a deeper look, I think you find incredible expanses of really remote and rural places that have incredible wildlife species. They have remote places that you can explore on foot or by vehicle that have mountains that you wouldn't expect, canyons that you can't see from far away, wildflower species that are maybe minute but beautiful. And I think it's the unexpected that one finds in the desert that is really intriguing, and that sense of really being out there.
When you talk about the tiny flowers and stuff, it almost sounds like a dry kind of tundra almost.
Well, I think there are some analogies that could be drawn there. Certainly the dryness results in different species on the landscape and a different feel to the place than you might find in a wet forest. But certainly it has many, many fans of the desert, and that's what we experience at Onda day in and day out, is people have a deep and abiding love for the high desert of eastern Oregon.
I kind of figured you pronounced it Onda. It seems sort of natural with that acronym, Oregon Natural Desert Association. Give us a little history lesson of Onda, would you?
Sure can. Onda was formed 26 years ago now by folks here in Bend in eastern Oregon who wanted to advocate for the high desert. Onda's mission is to protect, defend, and restore eastern Oregon's high deserts. And what we mean by that, Jeff, is we want to take care of this place. We want to make sure that the ecosystems there are intact and functioning. We want to make sure that people have the ability to go out and explore places as they have been for centuries. And we want for folks to engage with this incredible landscape.
Is there any part of the high desert considered more sensitive than any other? I mean, are there some places that are just a little more fragile?
Well, it's like any environment. There are places that are more sensitive, perhaps, to certain uses. I think we tend to view Oregon's high desert through the lens of wildlife habitat. And there are species that are more resilient to other uses of the landscape, and there are those that are more sensitive. Certainly one that has been the subject of a lot of discussion over the last several years is the greater sage grouse. And the greater sage grouse is a resilient species in many ways, but it does have sensitivities to certain types of impacts, and managing the habitat for that bird is an important task.
Well, the sage grouse is an interesting case because I know that there's been an ongoing battle over whether or not to list it as a threatened or endangered species. The Fish and Wildlife Service seems to indicate that the listing might be warranted but hasn't done so. What's the holdup there?
Well, actually, in September of 2015, the Fish and Wildlife Service determined that they would not list the greater sage grouse as an endangered species, mm-hmm. and instead rely on a series of plans that have been developed over the last several years to protect the habitat for the sage grouse. And, you know, there are those who would say that the choice not to list has been a mistake. For Onda, we are taking a cautious approach and saying, let's see if these plans can be effective in protecting habitat for this species. And by doing so, it does have benefits to more than 300 other species who rely on the same habitat type out there in the desert.
Is the sage grouse sort of like the high desert canary in the coal mine? Is it like the spotted owl of the high desert?
Well, certainly those kinds of comparisons have been thrown around. I prefer to think of the sage grouse as an important species and one that can tell us a lot about what's happening inside of the ecosystem without having to do a much deeper look all of the time. We know that the habitat is important for those 300 species and the sage grouse, and our objective as an organization is to make sure that habitat is functioning both for the sage grouse and for those other species, and it's helpful as an indicator.
What are the issues, then, that the sage grouse and therefore the high desert faces?
Some of the things that have been discussed most prominently and have the greatest impact for sage grouse are invasive species. Some folks may have heard the term cheatgrass, which is an invasive species from the Russian steppe that was imported before the turn of the century and has done incredibly well for itself, but has very little nutritional value for wildlife species or other uses, and is very prone to large-scale wildfire.
Okay. We're talking to Dan Morse, who is the Conservation Director at ONDA, the Oregon Natural Desert Association. Join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk specifically for a bit about the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. ONDA has put some work into that, I understand.
We have, yeah. For a number of years, there was a collaborative stakeholder effort to develop a plan for the refuge, to update their master plan, if you will. That culminated in 2012 with a new conservation plan for the area, and that was a new way of doing business for these refuge plans, to have multiple groups come together and talk about their priorities and focus in on a couple of the key issues for the refuge. And I think it's fair to say that not everyone got everything that they wanted out of that effort in this plan for the refuge, but by and large, folks were able to live with the result, and it's done some good for the place. One of the key issues there, oddly enough, is that there are carp, invasive carp, in the lakes at the refuge, and it's become a tremendous problem. And the group recognized that, agreed that it needed to be worked on, and since the finalization of that plan, there's been a lot of effort by the Fish and Wildlife Service to address that carp invasion.
Where'd the carp come from?
I think there are a number of stories about how they originally got there. Perhaps they were planted by someone who thought that that would be a nice recreational fishing species. Perhaps somebody disposed of them because they didn't want the carp. I don't think anyone truly knows.
Huh. Some of the other information about the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is on the verge of mind-blowing. How many birds visit the refuge?
Well, I was looking at some facts and figures yesterday. There are hundreds of species that visit the refuge in any given year, and for some of those species, as many as 70% of the total population of a species will visit the refuge each year. So it becomes a critical stopping point on that Pacific Flyway for quite a large number of species, but striking to me, almost all of a given bird will be on the refuge at some point during the year.
Wow, that is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
Now, ONDA wasted no time putting out a statement condemning the takeover at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge right at the beginning of the year. Outside of the headquarters area, what information do you have at this point about the general condition of the refuge?
Well, our impression is that outside of the immediate headquarters area, there wasn't a tremendous amount of activity during the illegal takeover. There were some outlying facilities that are privately owned that were apparently used for a time and may have experienced some impact. But by and large, this is a 180,000-acre wildlife refuge, Jeff. The area around the headquarters is perhaps a few hundred acres. So I think in large part the refuge fared fairly well. There are some ongoing maintenance activities and water management activities that apparently weren't being conducted during the takeover, and it's too early to know what sort of impacts that might have resulted in.
More broadly than across the high desert, I mean, you know, the high desert obviously is not a place that gets a lot of precipitation in the first place, but how have the recent drought years impacted the region?
Well, it's variable, as in any landscape. Some places experienced a more severe drought. Other places in the high desert, a lesser version. I think what we tend to see in eastern Oregon's high desert is in drought years we have a higher prevalence of wildfire ignitions, and then certainly larger wildfires are a possibility in those dry years. And that is when some of those invasive species can really make some ground because they're more adapted to those dry drought years.
Your highest goal at ONDA appears to be protecting wild places. Do you want to protect them as designated wilderness areas?
We have a variety of areas within eastern Oregon's high desert that we work on actively, and it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. In certain areas, we think that protecting wildlife habitat is certainly the most important, and there's a variety of designations or management tools that could accomplish that. In other areas, there are wilderness values that are maybe unequaled in some places of the western United States, And we think that wilderness designation would be an appropriate tool to protect those wilderness values.
So a real range of things then.
Absolutely.
Dan Morse is the conservation director at ONDA, the Oregon Natural Desert Association. You might have some stories to share about the desert or some questions to ask Dan about the approach to protecting it. Join us with questions and comments at 800-838-3760 over the phone by email jx@jeffnet.org. What are some of the particular values then you're seeking to protect just generally across high desert, whether it's as wilderness or something else?
Well, when we're talking about wilderness, Jeff, we're talking about places that are remote. They're natural, meaning that there aren't developments such as buildings or highways or, you know, that built environment that we see every day in our city lives. They have real wildlife habitat value. You can get away and hike or backpack or ride your horse and be away from the sights and sounds of people. Those values are important to our members, and I think they're important to all Americans. Those places to escape, you know, our increasingly modern life with constant connectivity. So that's on the wilderness end of things. When it comes to wildlife habitat, some of the things that are really important, riparian areas, places where there are water sources available for wildlife in the desert are critical. The lifeblood of the desert is the water, and because it's so rare, those places are increasingly in need of some form of protection.
Can it be a little harder to make a case for the protection of high desert? That it's not as romantic, for example, as forested hillsides, you know, and so when you're trying to tell people, well, we'd really rather not have the ATVs out in this stretch of the desert, you know, you get the response of, well, it is kind of wasteland.
Sure. Sure. Well, it may be a case of beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and we have a little work to do to understand the beauty that we're seeing. The term rock and ice has been used in describing how the United States has approached wilderness designation over the last 50 or 60 years. We've got a lot of places up in the high Rockies or the high Cascades that have been designated as wilderness because people associated those places with hard to get to and wildness and remoteness. Well, the desert is another form of beauty, and it's equally hard to get to, equally remote, and equally beautiful. And I think we have a task ahead of us to make sure that we've done a representative job of protecting all of the types of places we have in our country.
Let's take a phone call here. We have George in Wairika on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dan Morse from the Oregon Natural Desert Association.
Thank you very much.
Sure, go ahead.
We walked through General Patton's the tracks that had not been walked on for 50 years. And previously, we went over an area where the Mormon Trail went through Death Valley. However, I am interested in the coprolite and the area that it was found in the cave up there in the desert.
Oh, up in Lake County, yeah, for sure. Okay, thanks for that, George. Appreciate it. Dan, do you do any work with the preservation of that region?
Well, we do work in Lake County, Oregon, and particularly in the Hart-Sheldon region that is in Lake County between the Hart National Antelope Refuge and the Sheldon National Wildlife Refuge just across the state line in Nevada. And that is an area where we're really focused on the wildlife habitat. There's been some recent scientific studies indicating that the pronghorn antelope move hundreds of miles from fairly far south into Nevada to north of the Hart Wildlife Refuge. And that migratory corridor is a very important one for the pronghorn, but it also happens to be critically important for greater sage grouse. It's got one of the most intact and functioning populations of sage grouse in the state. And so we focused a lot of efforts on how we could best protect that area.
The coprolites that George is talking about refers to prehistoric poop, basically, from human beings. So the evidence is that that we had human beings in that part of Oregon, in what is now Lake County, a long, long time ago, potentially before the Clovis people, is the belief, isn't it?
Yeah, and not being a cultural resources expert, I won't step too far, but the area is rife with cultural resources, petroglyphs, pictographs, the coprolite, with which I'm not terribly familiar, but it has a long history in the caves and other places of that human occupation. And I think it's a rich one that can speak for some form of protection as well.
So let's talk about specific areas put up for protection. You're part of the Coalition for the Protection of the Owyhee Canyon Lands. Tell us about the plan there.
Yeah, the Owyhee Canyon Lands is an incredible area in far southeastern Oregon along the Owyhee River. More than a 3 million acre area, of which about 2.5 million acres We have proposed for legislative protection through a national conservation area designation and some wilderness designations.
Has it been? Has it undergone resource use? Have there been extractive industries there in the past?
There has not been a tremendous amount of mining or oil and gas development or that sort of extractive use in the past. There are indications that there's some oil and gas interest just across the state line in Idaho and to the north. And I think this is one of those places where we have an opportunity to do conservation work before impacts start to take place.
It seems to be something of a hot button for opponents. Is it because of the particular area, or is it because of the resistance to the creation of more protected areas?
You know, I don't know that I could say if it's one thing or another, Jeff. What I could say is I think it's important that there be dialogue amongst all folks interested in the Owyhee to ensure that we get to some good outcomes that address a host of different interests.
What are the steps that remain, then, to be considered before you get any sort of designation for the Owyhee Canyon lands?
I think there'll be continued outreach to the local community. There'll be continued dialogue with elected officials and land managers, and trying to identify what sorts of solutions can ensure the conservation of those wilderness areas and wildlife habitats, and at the same time address the interests of land users.
Dan Morse is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take a couple more minutes talking to him about the Oregon Natural Desert Association and what it does. He's the conservation director there. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You actually have a wilderness stewardship program at ONDA, is that right?
We do, yeah. ONDA's stewardship program works to bring people out into Oregon's high desert, both to familiarize them with the place and engage them with the place, and to do good for the resources, for the ground. So with about 40 trips per year, volunteers going out into the field, we take on an array of activities. Just by example, some of the things we might do in a given year, making fencing wildlife friendly, which is making sure that it's marked so that bird species can see it, making sure that it has appropriately spaced and high wires so that animals can move under or over it appropriately. Oftentimes we find ourselves building or taking out fencing that's obsolete or that needs to be replaced and can help with wildlife management or livestock management in better ways. Among the more technical work we sometimes do is restoring riparian areas that may have been degraded by past uses. And that involves things like planting new species and trying to decrease the erosion that's happened over time. And it's telling. I was just talking with folks last night. People from around the state and from around the region even will come on their own time and on their own dime to work in 100-degree weather in harsh desert environments to benefit the public lands. And I think it's reflective of how much they care about these places.
Is it? So do you have a fair amount of members in the moister parts of Oregon, in the Portland area, for example?
We do, actually, and you know, I think it's reflective of the population distribution of the state. We have membership in the rural portions of Oregon, and we have membership along the I-5 corridor and southern Oregon, and in Washington, Idaho, Nevada, and surrounding states.
For the benefit of people who don't really get to Eastern Oregon much or understand the land use out there, much was made, obviously, at the wildlife refuge takeover about how much cattle get loose on the range. How much of Oregon's high desert is rangeland, either public or private?
The vast majority of it is rangeland, and I would say that probably a greater percentage of that area is public lands and typically Bureau of Land Management administered.
So is there a particular figure you shoot for at ONDA, or is it more based on which areas you'd like to see things like grazing curtailed?
Yeah, no, it's very site-specific, Jeff. And the curtailment of grazing is not an objective at the outset by any means. It's ensuring that we have robust and functioning wildlife habitat and protected wild places and looking at that on a very specific case-by-case basis.
As technology goes on and we do things differently as a culture, are there additional new new challenges to the preservation of high desert? I ask this because, you know, here again, if people look at it as wasteland, they see these great places to put wind farms or solar farms or any one of a number of things in the renewable energy industry. And I just wonder how much pressure there is to locate those in high desert in eastern Oregon.
Well, certainly there's been interest in both wind and solar development in eastern Oregon's high desert over time. And I think we see fluctuations in that as we see fluctuations in the overall economy. With the push toward renewable energy, there will be continued interest. And one of our efforts at ONDA has been to identify places where renewable energy development would be most compatible, have the least conflict with wild places and wildlife habitat. And we've called that smart from the start or doing it right. And there are places that might be better suited for those forms of development, and we'd like to see that pursued in those areas. At the same time, there are places where it does not make sense, and places like sage-grouse habitat, the most important sage-grouse habitat, present conflicts for any form of development.
So before we go, Dan, give us a starter kit for the folks who might want to get used to high desert. What are like the first three places they should check out in Oregon's high desert?
Well, this is like picking a favorite child.
Of course.
Probably not advisable. But I think folks would really be interested to see Steens Mountain,
mm-hmm.
and many people have. The Heart Mountain region is tremendous and beautiful, and also the Owyhee Canyon lands, while very remote, are incredibly beautiful and worth seeing.
Great stories on the landscape in eastern Oregon in the high desert. Dan Morse is the Conservation Director of the Oregon Natural Desert Association, or ONDA. Dan, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.